So we tend to think of meanings as abstract statements about something, and the statement explains the something with some sort of clarity.
I'm Dr. Sarah Waters, and this is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2021. Today is the sixth and final episode of a series spotlighting the Fawns Bookshop, T.S. Lewis, on Why Myth Matters. The author, Dr. Charlie Starr, is here again to help us explore it. I'm co-hosting this special short series with William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of All About Jack. Take it away, William.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Well, let's see. Now, last time we explored part three, Terran Reality as Myth in Narnia. If any of our listeners have missed that or any previous episode, then be sure to check the show notes for direct links to those other shows. As noted, today is the final show in the series, and I hope everyone has enjoyed it and will consider getting Charlie's book if you haven't already. We're considering the fourth and last section in the Fawns bookshelf that is called Beyond the Bookshelf. Plus, we'll have Charlie summarize some of the first two parts of the book at the end of the show. We're not looking to revisit part three since we did that last time. People can just go back to that. So before having Sarah pitch the first question, welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thanks, William. Glad to be here.
So let's get stuck in. The 10th chapter is twice as long as almost every other chapter in the volume, so I'm afraid we can't hope to cover it all here. But Mythic Knowing is the title that you give it. One of the key ideas you cover is meaning in that chapter. In fact, you asked, what does it mean? So I was wondering if you could give us a kind of brief sketch of this chapter.
Yeah, one of the things that really made me understand the power of myth was coming to an understanding of the nature of meaning. We will often ask the question, what does this mean? What does that mean? We seldom ask the question, what does meaning mean? But I can describe how we tend to think of the word meaning by using an example. I can remember when my daughter was around 10 years old that, like any good father would do, I made sure she saw the classics, including the Star Wars trilogy, the original trilogy. So we're a big film family, and my daughter was watching The Empire Strikes Back for the first time with me. And there's this wonderful scene where Luke Skywalker goes down into a cave, and there he confronts Darth Vader. And he cuts Vader's head off, and the mask explodes, and there, staring out of the mask, is Luke Skywalker himself. Well, my daughter asked then, well, what did that mean? And I explained to her, well, it means that Luke's worst enemy is not really Darth Vader. Luke's worst enemy is himself, and he's got to conquer himself before he can conquer any external enemies.
Well, Charlie, wait a minute. Did you say spoiler alert, or do you consider, since these movies are a few years old, that most people should have known this twist here?
Well, I am hopeful that our culture hasn't sunk so low that no child has failed to see, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy at this point. So sorry for not mentioning the spoiler there, but you know, at least I didn't say that, you know, Darth Vader is actually Luke's father. That would have just really ruined things. Okay. So, yeah. And Snape killed Dumbledore anyway. I explained the meaning of the scene in words. I made a statement, and that is frequently how we talk about meaning. Somebody asks, well, what does that mean? And we explain it in words, and the words are statements about. So what does that look that you are giving me mean? And then I have to explain, I wasn't giving you a look, I promise, or it means X. So we're talking about some experience, some film, some poem, some Bible passage. It's very popular to sit in a Sunday school class and read the parables and then ask the question, so what does that mean? So we tend to think of meanings as abstract statements about something, and the statement explains the something with some sort of clarity. Well, what I learned from C.S. Lewis and his friend Owen Barfield is that meanings are not always abstract statements. Meanings can be concrete things. Certain sounds, apart from language, may mean something to you without anyone ever needing to explain what the meaning is. We like a particular movie, and there is a soundtrack to that movie. And if we hear the soundtrack, we're automatically connected to that film without anybody having to say, oh, hey, this is the soundtrack to Raiders of the Lost Ark or anything like that. So meanings are not always statements. If somebody is coughing or if somebody, let's say somebody sneezes, another person might reply, Gesundheit. Well, that's because we all know what a sneeze is, and we don't have to explain what the sneeze is. So meanings can be done, you know, made without necessarily making statements, without particularly using language at all. So if my child comes in to the room and hands me his report card from school, and before I open the report card, I say, dun 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 dun. See, that is a sound from a famous song that my child will take as ominous. I can think of another example in terms of watching a movie with my daughter. We were watching a cartoon together when she was only about 3 or 4, and there was some ominous music that began to play. And she said, "Daddy, I'm scared." And I thought, had to think about that, because there wasn't anything scary yet. Not to see, but she had already learned by then, because clearly I'd allowed her to watch too much TV, she had already learned that certain kinds of music, apart from any words in the music, have certain kinds of meaning. And so there was suspense music playing, the kind of music that gave her the cue to know that something scary was about to happen in the film. So there was a great example of a meaning that wasn't a statement at all. The second thing that I learned, and I learned this very specifically from Lewis, is that meanings aren't always true. In his famous essay, Blusples and Philanthropies, Lewis says that the imagination is the organ of meaning and that reason is the organ of truth. Before we can have any kind of meanings to reason with, however, we have to apprehend them in the imagination. And the meanings that we get might be true, but they might also be false. And it's up to reason to make that determination. And so, for example, if I say something like, "What a lovely color of plaid the sky is today," then you will know what I mean, and you'll know that the meaning is a little bit absurd. You know what plaid is. And if I claim that the sky is plaid, then you will say that's a false statement. It is nevertheless a meaning. Okay, you understood that meaning. So meanings aren't always necessarily going to be true, and they're not always necessarily going to be language. Meanings, the third thing I learned is that meanings can be experiential. And again, this can be divorced from language. As I experience things in life, things come to have meanings to me. So, for example, if I am a four-year-old and my mom tells me, "Don't touch the stovetop, it's hot," but I'm kind of stupid, so I'm going to do it anyway, I will learn from experience what hot means. And I will never have to be told again not to touch a hot stove. So meanings can come through language. We can talk about them. We can define words. Lewis does a wonderful job of that in a book like The Four Loves, in which he tells us what the four different Greek words for love were. Meanings can be musical. Meanings can be sounds. We might hear the barking of a dog. And that's not the same as words. The dog might be sharing its particular language. We can get meanings from facial expressions. A whole lot of the meaning that we communicate is what's called nonverbal meaning. to people. That's how you know you're in trouble with your wife, is when she gives you the look. Had a nice trip with William and his wife. There was at least once or twice when he got the look, right? So, oh, about five? Okay, yeah. He's losing count. So meanings can be experiential. And another thing I learned, and I talk about this in the book, is that as much as Lewis loved the imagination and as much as he thought myth was important, and he very specifically said, myth is something that we apprehend in the imagination, Lewis understood that imagination could be dangerous. If the imagination is able to capture, is the organ of meaning, and if some of those meanings can be false, then the imagination can be fooled into thinking that those meanings are true. And this is something Lewis will talk about in a variety of places, but especially in a book like The Screwtape Letters, when he says, for example, make sure you don't allow your patient to use his reason. Instead of having him focus on arguments, have him focus on jargon, on words that sound like they mean a lot, that sound like they are true, but the language has been so muddled up that you can make people think that they're thinking correctly when in fact they are not, because instead of actually dealing with real ideas, you've only been dealing with meanings. And that can be a very dangerous thing. Meaning is powerful. Meaning, another thing I learned then is that meanings can be singular or meanings can be multiple. And so a single line in a poem may be referring to several things at once and not just some individual thing. And one of the powers that we can find then in art is that art can communicate multiple meanings at once. I think that's true in visual arts as well as language arts. I think film is incredibly capable of layering meanings on top of meanings so that multiple things are being spoken at once. But of course, Lewis and his love of poetry would have pointed out the many meanings that you can get out of a single line in a particular poem. So yeah, meaning is important. It's important to myth because myth is apprehended in the imagination, and the imagination is the organ of meaning. But ultimately, I talk about meaning in the book not just to say, here is how myth functions, and that's a big part of what this chapter is doing, but it's also there to say the way we have been taught to think in a post-Enlightenment world, that is, this is something that goes back 300 or 400 years, a problem that we're facing since the 1700s, the way we have been taught to think is incredibly limiting. We have failed to understand the epistemological importance of imagination, and central to that is a false belief that meanings are things that can only be put into words. If you can't put it into words, it doesn't mean anything, and that's simply not true. Myths often can't be put into words. In fact, Lewis would say, as soon as we begin to try to analyze a myth, we're taking the myth and turning it into an allegory. Lewis would say, there's nothing wrong with doing that so long as we realize there's a difference. Myth is something we receive in the imagination, and it is therefore like an experience. You can think about the experience, you can think about the myth, you can analyze it, but then you're not receiving it as myth anymore. In the same way that if you're head over heels, Google-eyed, Twitter-pated in love, you're not busy thinking about what love is. You're too busy being in love to do it. Lewis would say, you're looking along the beam rather than at the beam, going back to meditation in a tool shed, right? Well, sometimes, though, you do have to step back and look at the beam, especially if you keep falling in love with the wrong person over and over again, right? Maybe learn some lessons from that. All right, I got it right the first time with my lovely wife, married 36 years now. And there we go, meaning, Lewis and meaning.
Well, let's see. I have another question, but I'm not sure if I can put it into words, so I'm going to telepathically say it to you. No. play on
the answer
words.
Is yes.
Okay, yes, yes. Okay, which was, when you get $1 million, you'll give it to me. So thank you. Now, I want to have you talk a little bit about Owen Barfield, whom you've mentioned before. In fact, you just mentioned him a moment ago, and the impact he had on Lewis, especially in terms of understanding myth. In this chapter, you cover it in some detail. Share some of the things that you note.
Owen Barfield is Lewis's great secret influencer. Barfield doesn't get enough credit for influencing Lewis's conversion to theism. But even before that, Barfield had a strong influence on Lewis's theory of language and theory of poetry. Barfield had a similar strong influence on J.R.R. Tolkien. So if the audience listening to this podcast is just really interested in the Inklings, in Lewis, in Tolkien, there is at least one Owen Barfield book that you have to read. And that is the book Poetic Diction. In that book, Barfield lays out a theory of language which is radically different than the theories of language that were being proposed early in his lifetime. Poetic Diction was written very early in Barfield's career. It was written in the 20s and was an extension of his BA thesis, as I understand it. George Lucas said, here I go back to Star Wars, myth is psychological archaeology. I think I've mentioned that in the podcast in the past. So for Owen Barfield, language was psychological archaeology. Barfield would say, if you look into the past, you're going to see that people used words differently than they use them today. I don't mean that words change their meaning. I mean that the very nature of the way words were used was different. And that, in Barfield's mind, is because we both thought and experienced differently. So we experienced reality differently, according to Barfield, and we thought about reality differently. And one of the things that was different is that our experience and our thoughts were much more closely wedded together. So as Lewis talks about looking at the beam versus along the beam, stepping back and looking at a thing abstractly versus experiencing it concretely, Barfield would say in the ancient past, those two things were wedded together so that to think and to experience were much closer to each other. He even coined the idea of concrete thought. Today we talk about thought as abstractions about reality. Barfield would say that thought was much more like a physical thing in the far, far past, and that words were much more like physical things. That was such a strange idea to me that I had to really think about it. But what occurred to me is that there is this moment in Scripture where this idea is borne out at least a little bit, and it is the moment when Jacob and Esau are about to receive blessings from Isaac, and the most important blessing is the one that's supposed to go to Esau. Well, Jacob tricks Isaac into giving him the blessing instead. And when Esau goes to his father and says, give me your blessing, and the father realizes he's tricked, he says, I have no more blessing to give you. Well, why not? It's just words, right? Not to them. And maybe in some spiritual reality, words were different. Words did have some sort of physical power. I mean, words can certainly wound people in our day, can't they? But what if things were different in a time that was closer to the fall of man? What if language had a potency and a power that we no longer have? Lewis talks about that in a poem called The Birth of Language, where language is this concrete thing that falls from Mercury's sphere down to Earth, and as it does, all of its skin is stripped away and nothing is left but the abstract bones. So Lewis was very interested in the possibility that language was a radically different thing far in the past. Something that's significant that you see in Lewis in this regard is the idea of, and you see it in Barfield, is the idea of the word become flesh. All right. So we think about the idea of the word made flesh. John's gospel is Lewis's favorite, and John 1:1 is a key verse in Barfield's own philosophy. The word is concrete. It's real. It's a person. We think of words as just words, but when Christ came to the earth, Word himself, capital W, was a concrete reality. Plato's transcendent ideals, which for Plato had concrete reality. Ideas like justice and beauty and truth and what a chair is, right? All these kinds of things that for Plato had a kind of external and eternal reality. For Barfield, distinctions disappeared. A distinction between the abstract and the concrete. A distinction between the literal and the figurative. A distinction between sign and signified, between a word and what that word represents. Far in the past, says Barfield, words weren't symbols for something. They were the thing. So that's a very interesting idea. But I really like how, for Barfield, the idea of the literal and the figurative did not exist as separations for peoples in the past. And he gives us this example that still works in our culture with our language today. If I say I have no stomach for that, I might be saying that I don't like something, and so I'm being figurative. If I say I have no stomach for modern art, I'm saying I don't like modern art. If I say, however, I have no stomach for horror films, not only am I saying I don't like horror films, but I might be saying that they make me queasy, right? And so there's a literal meaning and a figurative meaning there, and both those meanings are fused together. And so for Barfield, that's a really significant idea. Ancient man, he would go on to say, thought that way all the time. And that then led to Barfield's concept of true metaphor. And this then is important in terms of Barfield's theory of myth. Myth is complex meaning which connects all these disparate parts, the abstract and the concrete, the literal and the figurative, things together, and brings multiplicity to meaning. And true metaphor then is seeing connections in the world that show us some truth about the world. Barfield's approach to imagination is in fact different from Lewis's, where Lewis saw dangers in looking for imaginative truth. Barfield thought it's in the imagination that we can encounter truth. And I wouldn't say Lewis didn't think so, but Lewis was much more cautious about it and specific about it than Barfield in this particular case. But Barfield writes that reality was once self-evident and therefore not conceptually experienced, but now such knowing can only be reached by an effort of the individual mind. Barfield explains this point in an appendix. He says, the distinction between true and false metaphor corresponds to the distinction between myth and allegory. Allegory being a more or less conscious hypostatization, well, that's a hard word to say, hypostatization of ideas, and myth, the true child of meaning begotten on imagination. So for Barfield, myth is the true child of capital M meaning begotten on imagination. And this sort of gets to the main point of looking at Barfield's poetics. He believes that myth, or true metaphor, is the act of perceiving a unity of objects with objects, or with objects and ideas, not as an abstract relationship, but as a concrete singularity. He illustrates by noting that poets throughout the ages have connected death with sleep and winter, and birth with waking and summer. Images that are often used as metaphors for various spiritual experiences, especially the shedding of the corruptible body by the soul and its subsequent putting on of the incorruptible. Barfield then says, along the conceptual lines of a true metaphor, that if this concept is right, some older undivided meaning should exist from which all these logically disconnected but poetically connected ideas have sprung. And he says this is exactly what he finds in the myth of Demeter and Persephone. In the myth of Demeter, the ideas of waking and sleeping, of summer and winter, of life and death, of mortality and immortality are all lost in one pervasive meaning. And so the audience then is going to want to check out the story of Demeter and of Persephone to see how that is the case. Another example that Barfield gives then is of the word spirit. Spirit is a common word in our New Testament. And that word, interestingly, has multiple meanings. It may refer to spirit as we just understand it in our time. It might also refer to breath, such as the idea of breathing the breath of life into someone. It might also refer to wind. Barfield believed that for ancient man, all these meanings were inherent in the individual word. They wouldn't have thought of spirit as being different as wind. They would have thought of the wind as spirit. And they would have thought of all these things, wind, breath, and spirit, as a single unified meaning. And that's what myth is born on. Myth is born on these multiple meanings. So how can I put this into something that's a little more concrete for us to understand? If you have ever seen a film or a scene in a film or heard a song that made you go, wow, that was incredible, that was overwhelming, and I don't know quite why, but you sense that there's something larger in that film that you saw or something larger in the song that you heard, and this can even work with a painting, and there's something deeper, more meaningful in that, you're starting to capture what I talk about when I talk about mythic knowing, a kind of knowing that is ancient and very old to us. Lewis describes it when he tries to talk about what Narnia meant in the last battle. So in the last battle, they're in the new Narnia. Oh, there's another spoiler alert, William. In the last battle, everyone has died and they've all gone to the new Narnia. All right. And where they're perfectly alive and everything is wonderful. But the new Narnia is like the old Narnia. And what they realize is that the new Narnia is the real Narnia. And the old one was just a shadow of this real Narnia. And one of the things then that the narrator says is everything, even every blade of grass, looked like it meant more. And then he says, now, how do you explain that? He says, well, if you've ever been on a vacation and you can look out of your hotel room, I think I added the vacation and hotel room part, but anyway, if you're ever looking out a window and you see a beautiful landscape or a beautiful seascape, all right, that sense of beauty is impacting you, you can feel it. And then all of a sudden, if you were to turn and you were to see the same view in a mirror, you're seeing the same landscape or the same seascape, and you're seeing it in a mirror. And somehow in the mirror, it looks more wonderful to you. It looks like some magical place, something out of a fairy tale book. And somehow you're seeing the exact same thing you saw out the window, but now it means so much more. And the narrator says, that's as close as I can get to describing what the new Narnia was like. Otherwise, you're just going to have to go there and experience it for yourself to really understand it. So Owen Barfield had a theory of language that really makes sense of myth itself. In fact, after Lewis read Poetic Diction the second time after it had been published, because he'd read it before prior to publication, he said, if what you are saying about language is true, then there's going to have to be some serious study of myth and its nature. And today, of course, we've had that for decades, especially with the work of Joseph Campbell. But when Lewis wrote that in 1928 or so, there hadn't been a lot yet. You know, Fraser's great study of mythology had come out, but the study of myth as a mode of knowing That is something that was brand new, and Barfield, I won't say was the first person to introduce it, but he may have very well been among the very first. At any rate, Tolkien said, after he read Poetic Diction, he couldn't look at language the same way again. Anytime you wanted to say something about language, especially the evolution of language, you had to keep Barfield in mind. And Lewis certainly believed the same thing. And many of Barfield's ideas come out then in a variety of Lewis's books, especially in how Lewis approaches language in the third of his science fiction novels, That Hideous Strength. So Barfield, a huge influence on Lewis, though subtly perceived.
That's great. Thank you very much. So moving to chapter 11, you look northwards, or at least you talk a little bit about the love that Lewis had for Norse mythology. What are some kind of highlights from that chapter?
Yeah, after I was essentially finished with the book, in terms of talking about the four books on Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf and about some basic mythic theory, well, and some advanced mythic theory, chapter 10 is twice the length of the other chapters for a reason. I realized you cannot talk about C.S. Lewis and myth without also talking about his love for Norse mythology, because that's where his love of myth really began. There are other small things you can point to, like his some love of nature, but his first real love of myth probably comes from Norse mythology more than Greek mythology, though Greek mythology is heavily placed in the Narnia books, especially The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so I said, well, we need to have a chapter on Lewis and Norse mythology. So he talks about in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, a couple of different moments where Norse mythology just absolutely captivated him. One was when he was reading a poem by Longfellow called Tegner's Drapa. And he read the opening lines, I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead, which is a great set of opening lines. That's all Lewis quotes, but the rest of it's fantastic too. I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead, and echoed in the misty air like the mournful cry of sunward sailing cranes. So just way cool. Anyway. Lewis said he was suddenly swept up into northernness, into a sense of cold, rugged spaces and places, of open skies, gray and foreboding. And he didn't even know who Balder was. But that's what myth does. Myth doesn't communicate always ideas that we can understand. Half of what myth is communicating to us, it's communicating to us aesthetically. It's communicating to us in our imaginations. It's communicating beyond reason or underneath reason, if you will, as an experience. And the other time he talks about then as a child when it happens. So one event was when he was 9. Another one was when he was around 13 or 14. He was looking through a book of Arthur Rackham's illustrations for, I believe, Wagner's Ring Cycle. And one of the pictures that he hit on, just sent him into northernness. All right, so I probably got those details a little bit fuzzy. But at any rate, yeah, I know for sure it was an Arthur Rackham illustration from the Ring Cycle that he was looking at, and that made him experience that northernness. Well, he loved Norse myth throughout the rest of his life, and Norse myth then had a strong influence on him in a couple of ways. One was he made one of his best lifelong friends because they both loved Norse myth, and that friend was Arthur Greaves. Lewis wrote several thousand letters to Arthur. And some of the letters that he wrote are really important for us to understand how Lewis's conversion, for example, worked, or some of Lewis's other key ideas. So his friendship with Arthur Greaves is very important, and Arthur saved every letter that Lewis wrote to him. Additionally, they were going to write a opera together called Loki Bound about the Norse god Loki, and Lewis was going to make him the hero of the story, and Arthur Greaves was supposed to write the music for it. Another huge influence, very important influence then, is Lewis is becoming friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, and it was certainly their love of Norse myth that brought them together, and that also then brought Lewis into Tolkien's world of Middle Earth, which has that very Norse feel to it in many of its stories. So when we think about how instrumental Tolkien was in Lewis's conversion to Christianity, and when we think about how instrumental Lewis was to Tolkien's finishing The Lord of the Rings, Lewis's love for Norse myth turns out to be very important. And then finally, we'll say, and I briefly mentioned this in the book, and now it's finally out in publication, Hal Poe, Harry Lee Poe, in volume two of his biography of Lewis, published a document that half of a recording of a recording that Lewis made to be sent to Iceland that was going to be read over the airwaves during World War II. And Lewis was supposed to talk about the debt that English literature owes to Icelandic literature. It's fascinating to read Dr. Poe's discussion on how Lewis was actually working for what today we might call MI5. Would it be MI5 or MI6, Sarah? You probably shouldn't answer that, right? That might be dangerous. Anyway, Lewis, Poe suggests tongue-in-cheek the idea that Lewis was a British spy. That's really not quite the case, but take a look at Harry Lee Poe's biography of Lewis to get the full story of this lost Lewis broadcast on Norse, on Icelandic literature. So that's the chapter on Lewis and Norse mythology. I'll say one more thing, that for the American edition of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Lewis tried to add in more Norse mythology. He took some of the Greek references out and put in some Northern references. Unfortunately, it's very hard to get the American edition anymore. But if any of the audience are lovers of Narnia and you want to reread The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, change the name of the White Witch's chief of police, the Wolf Maugrim, change that to Fenris Ulf. And then look at some Norse mythology about the great wolf Fenrir. And then the fire stones, or the stone written on the stones on the fire hill, where the witch is talking about the rules about the deep magic, how she owns Edmund since he's a traitor. Lewis changes that in the American edition from stones on the fire hill to runes written as deep as a spear is long on the world ash tree. And then look up your Norse mythology on the world ash tree Yggdrasil, and you'll see some wonderful things there.
Ah, quite fascinating, Charlie. Well, we're going to start to wrap up by asking a few final questions here in terms of your book that we're talking about here, The Faun's Bookshelf. And you, at the end here, you leave the reader with a puzzle. Give us the title of that last chapter, and then a brief overview of the issue, and then not all of, but just some of the solution, as we want people to have to run out to their computer, what they're probably listening to on their computer, but run out to their bookstore or to log onto their computer and order a copy of your book. So give us a taste of some of those elements there.
In chapter 12, I took up a problem with Lewis's theory of myth that scholars have been fiddling with for several decades. The title of chapter 12 is An Interpretive Mystery of Mythic Proportion. And the mystery is just that Lewis seems to make one contradictory statement about myth across two different texts in his lifetime. The earliest one is from his early prose Joy, which was published a few years ago in the journal Seven. This was Lewis's earliest attempt to write a biography about his conversion. At that time, he wasn't even a Christian yet. It was just his conversion to theism. But in the early prose Joy, he wrote that referring to what he was believing about God, he felt God saying to him, it is mythology, it is truth, not fact, an image, not the very real. And then that's something that Lewis repeats in his allegorical autobiography, Pilgrim's Regress. But then in the decade of the 40s, so this is almost 20 years later, in his essay, Myth Became Fact, Lewis says, what flows into you from the myth is not truth, but reality. So in the early prose Jorah, we get that myth is truth, not fact. And in Myth Became Fact, we get that myth is reality, not truth. And fact and reality for Lewis are the same thing. So basically, in the one, he's saying myth is truth, not reality. In the other, he's saying myth is reality, not truth. Well, how do we reconcile that? What was Lewis intending to say? And several people have theories as to possible answers. What I realized in writing that final chapter was that if I wanted to try to work through a full answer, the book was going to be another 50 or 100 pages long, because you couldn't just talk about myth. You also had to talk about Lewis's theory of fact and reality and Lewis's theory of truth. So I raised the problem and suggested possible answers, but did not argue them all the way through. My personal idea about what the best answer is that for Lewis, myth connects us to a higher reality. It does not connect us to abstract truth. It connects us to something that's concretely real, and as such, it is true. But not truth in the earthly sense of being abstract. But the one time then when he says that the myth of God is true, not truth, not fact, I think what Lewis is saying is that myth connects us to higher reality unless it is a myth about the nature of God himself. Then even a myth about God is still going to be an abstraction, and it's still only going to be something closer to truth than to what God really is. So that's the closest answer I've been able to get to reconcile those two passages. But others have written about it. Peter Schockel has written about it in Reason and Imagination in C.S. Lewis. Stephen Thorson has written about it in his wonderful study of Lewis's Great War with Owen Barfield, and forthcoming book by Norbert Feindendegen on Lewis's epistemology will cover the issue as well.
That's great. Thank you very much. So now we're moving to a kind of recap of the first couple of parts that we recorded before. So the first part of your book is called Folios and Forms. Maybe if you could just pick one of the chapters and summarize a few of your points to kind of preview what we covered before.
All right. So from part one, Folios and Fauns, I think if there is a chapter I like most, it's the Folios chapter. And that is, it's the chapter on the making of many fake books. Lewis loved to write books, and then he loved to write non-books. That is, he loved to come up with great ideas for books, which never then actually got written, come up with fun titles for them. And of course, the four books on Mr. Thomas's bookshelf are a great example of that. So that chapter just plays with Lewis's love for creating even fictional books for his fictional worlds, and some neat things on his relationship with Tolkien on that as well. So lots of fun.
All right, Charlie, well then now the impossible task here. We're going to have you reflect on the second part of your book, Narnian Reality and Terran Myth. Select one of those chapters and highlight some of the aspects.
I would say the chapter I like most from that section of the book is the chapter on why Sylvan myths matter so much to Lewis. Why do nature gods and nature myths matter so much to him. And it's because they're incarnational. They are a type of the sacramental. They're a type of the incarnation when Christ comes to earth, when the divine descends to earth. So that's a significant idea there. There's also the idea that nature is not just a machine. The mechanistic view of nature, which arose with the development of science, is not the way Lewis would have us think about nature. He would want us to think of it as alive, as a living organism, and therefore as being much more meaningful. And then the separation of spirit from nature, Lewis would reject that. In his mind, the incarnation of Christ is the moment when spirit and flesh begin to come back together. And though he recognizes that the world must be remade, nevertheless, he sees value in the world, in the wedding feast of Cana and the making of wine, which, as he calls it, is the unmasking of Bacchus, where we see who the true god of wine is. And so stripping meaning from nature then would be the last element. Any kind of mechanistic view and any kind of view of nature devoid of life ultimately strips the meaning from the world. We empty the universe of all of its significance of meaning until we're finally starting to do it to ourselves, even, so that we lose our mythic wonder and ability, which then is something we mentioned last time in talking about the Is Man a Myth chapter.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So shifting gears slightly, previously you mentioned a new book project, and I was wondering if you could just recap for our audience what that was, and if there's any new information about it, that would be great to know too.
I've written a book on Lewis's theory of the real. And we even talked about that here on this podcast, how if we really wanted to understand the relationship of myth, truth, and fact, or myth, truth, and reality, for that last chapter in the Fawn's bookshelf, it would take a whole lot of study. Because Lewis had a whole lot to say about truth, but even more to say about reality and the nature of the real. And there has been a little bit of writing done about that, but I don't think enough to really capture the understanding that Lewis was enamored of all of God's creation. God, who is the great I Am, God, who is being himself or reality himself. Lewis refers to him as the first, foremost, and most concrete fact there is in several places. That's what Lewis wants to get at. He wants to not even know about the real as much as he wants to know reality himself and then the reality that himself has made, that God has made. So there's just a lot to talk about in terms of a theory of the real, according to C.S. Lewis. So the new book, which I am currently hoping will be a kind of sequel to the Fawn's bookshelf, the working title is The Lion's Country, C.S. Lewis on What's Really Real. And of course, that could change. The publisher often will want something different, and that's fine. We'll see where that goes. That I do have a draft of that done. I'm going to take it through another draft now. The publisher has it, though, and they are very interested. We haven't said yes because I decided it needed to go through another draft. But I also then have a wonderful Lewis critic, and we're going to keep this a secret for a little while, but we have a wonderful Lewis critic who has agreed to write the foreword for the book, and this critic is also going to make me some nice suggestions for the revision. I'll just say that this Lewis scholar is very interested in the idea of collaboration and wants to help me then to make sure this book can be as good as it possibly can. With any luck then, before the fall is out, before the new year is over or before this year, 2021 ends, the publisher will have said 100% yes. I think they're mostly there at this point anyway, and maybe we'll even have a publication date. But for now, the work continues.
At the time of this recording, which is late August 2021, so those listening to this at a later date, maybe this book has been out for years, and people have maybe enjoyed it, and then there are some now listening to it near its release will have a taste of what's forthcoming.
Yeah, 2022 would be awesome. And I'm also hopeful that the book that Sarah and William are working on together, which we talked about in an earlier podcast, will be not long for its completion. But as I understand it then, Sarah, you are also working on some projects in relation to Lewis and his love for the works of William Shakespeare. I was hoping that you'd catch us up on what's going on with your love projects.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's right. I am working on a couple of books at the moment. Well, I'm primarily working on a book on Shakespeare and Narnia, or rather Lewis's engagement with Shakespeare in Narnia. So when we see characters from Shakespeare's plays popping up in Narnia, what does that mean? And kind of exploring how Lewis both creatively and critically engages with Shakespeare in Narnia. So looking at, for example, the chapter I'm working on at the moment is looking at The Tempest and how that influenced Narnia and what it is that Lewis is doing. And kind of connected to that, but slightly separated, I suppose, is the other book project that I'm working on. And that is looking at Lewis and Shakespeare much more broadly, and what Lewis is doing with Shakespeare when he engages with him across his canon. So it's looking at how Lewis read Shakespeare and what we see in Lewis's readings of Shakespeare, both in his criticism and then how that appears in his fiction and his apologetics as well, and his poetry and his letters, and looking at quite a lot of material that hasn't been published, where Lewis is reading Shakespeare and making notes and saying really interesting things, which we then see filtered through into his writing. So that second book project is tentatively, but very provisionally, currently called Lewis and Shakespeare, Engagements with Shakespeare on the Margins and Fringes. But is really looking at that intersection between Lewis the critic and Lewis the writer more broadly, and basically why no one's paid attention to the fact that he references Shakespeare a lot in his writing.
Oh, very good. Thank you, Sarah, for sharing about those solo book projects. Best wishes on them. And now, with that, though, I'm afraid we're going to do a final conclusion, or we have now concluded this these six episodes. This was the final part on the Fawn's Bookshelf with Dr. Charlie Starr. I hope everyone has enjoyed it. And don't forget, if you missed any of the other episodes, that you can check the show notes for direct links to them. But before we go, a final thank you, Charlie, for joining Sarah and I for this series.
Well, and I thank you, William, for highlighting my Fawn's Bookshelf for so many episodes in the podcast. And I thank you then for doing the podcast now for a decade plus. I think it makes a difference. I think you're reaching an audience who might miss some things otherwise. It's been a blast being your friend for this decade. And Sarah, my thanks to you too. William and I and some of our friends from our generation, like our good friend Devin Brown, constantly talk about who's next, what's going to happen next. We look around at all the Lewis scholars in the world and we say, man, these guys are starting to get some gray. We're all getting older, so you represent the next generation. We're so glad that you're doing the work that you're doing, that you'll carry the torch for years to come on Lewis' work. Thank you both. This has been a great, great series.
And let me formally thank Sarah as well for her co-hosting duties for this series. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. It's been great fun.
And that's how the final recording with Charlie and Sarah ended. So thanks for your interest in this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com, where you will find a variety of content, including, of course, previous episodes of All About Jack. But the most popular part of the site is a series of articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard the last episode in the mini-series about the Fonz Bookshelf. Have you heard all six shows? If not, then check the show notes for links to the previous episodes. Plus, you can find a direct link in the show notes to purchase Charlie's book, and there are also links to anything else mentioned during the show. Plus, there's a link to help you locate other episodes where Charlie was a guest, apart from this mini-series, which I hope you'll share with others. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.